check in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And here we are in the Allstate Showcase Studio. It is 10 minutes after 12. Welcome to Tuesday afternoon on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. I hope you had a great long holiday weekend and are back at it. They're back at it on Wall Street. And the numbers aren't so good so far. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is trading down about 450 points earlier today. A lot of this has to do with what's going on in Europe and concern over the Eurozone. Kim Gordon is in the newsroom. She's following this and, well, maybe Starbucks more closely. I know you were checking earlier. Do we know what time the Starbucks restaurant are closing today?
We do. And in Chicago, I don't know about the suburbs, but in Chicago, we're told 2:30 and they'll be closed for the rest of the day.
Oh, really? So yeah. I thought it was going to be just a couple of hours.
Yeah, it appears like it's going to go. It's an all day afternoon thing.
And I know Ryan Burrow from WGN was in Bronzeville talking to a couple of the groups who are calling for not just retraining, but for more of a boycott as well. You talk to a lot of people. I know you enjoy Starbucks. I have a cup in my hand every day when I do this show. Do you think that there's been any fall off in business, or do you think that this has hurt them at all?
Well, you know, I mean, we go to this Michigan Avenue store, and it's always packed with people coming in and out. But I don't know if you noticed, I guess it was almost 6 months ago, a year, they put a code on the bathroom door. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And people were a little upset about that, wanting to use the bathroom, and you had to ask for the code, and they said if you didn't buy anything, you couldn't use the bathroom. So I don't know if they got any flack here, you know, across the street. I know there's a lot of people coming in and out. You know, the bathrooms can get dirty, but how can you monitor that?
Well, I just feel like that it's not outside, shouldn't be outside their rights or abilities to block people who aren't customers from using the restrooms. I mean, you know, we're over there quite a bit at this store, and there are homeless people who come in and out, and they have to, you know, watch them. I mean, let's face it, someone who's homeless, who's been on the street for a while they certainly need shelter and all, they bring with them a lot that's not desirable and would hurt a businesswoman or a businessman's efforts to raise money. I understand why there might be some backlash there.
It's understandable, but, you know, especially the guys that sit out of this Starbucks, they've almost adopted them, you know? I mean, there's so many that know their names, and everybody's buying them food and, you know, knows their story. I mean, you know me. I talk to them all the time. But, you know, it happens. You befriend the people that are sitting there, and you can monitor what's going on and what's not.
I agree with that. I know who you're talking about, but there are others as well that I've seen where they have been trouble in that particular store. All right, so there's that. Also, I was just reading today that there is a new president of Aston Martin America, and it is a woman. And we're hoping to talk, or we will talk a little bit later in the program with Dale Buss. He's a reporter for Forbes, talks about the auto industry, and he's writing about Ford and the fact that they're getting rid of their sedans. I think they're going to print. They're going to make the Mustang.
Will she be the second woman? Because we have the woman at GM also, right?
Right. So she's got a message for women, according to the article, of girls to get involved in the automotive industry. Do you have a sedan in your house?
We do not.
Yeah, it's just
only SUVs and a two-seater car. But yeah, we do not have a sedan.
You know, it's all about crossovers. It's all about pickup trucks for Ford. And I just wonder where we're going to be. Now, I think they've got some developments in their engines as well that help them there. But I just wonder what's going to happen when gas prices start to go up again, because they're certainly going to go up. They're not always going to go down.
I don't know. Their pickups are so popular. You know, I grew up in Louisville, and
right.
The F-350 is made there, so people are very proud of those trucks. And I know it's just a really popular car.
Now, in Louisville, they aren't driving around the F-150s with the gun racks in the back, are they?
Of course they are, Steve.
Okay. One of my favorite stories, Sharon used to travel for business, and I think she was in Dallas, and she had to rent a car, and all that was available were pickup trucks, and from Hertz or Avis or wherever, it came with a gun rack in the back.
That makes it much more fashionable.
That's Kim Gordon in the WGN Newsroom. She'll continue to follow the day's developments and keep us updated on that. Oh, a little bit later in the program, too, we're going to talk to, and I'm going to try this name right now. We'll do it again later, Dale Okorodudu. He is the founder of Black Men in White Coats, the author of a book called How to Raise Your Child to Be a Doctor. Interesting guy. He focuses on pre-med students and getting them along and through school, but he heard from a lot of parents saying, I want my kid to be a doctor. So he started talking to a lot of different parents about their children and about what it was that drew them to medicine. And I think you might find that it's the sort of good parenting advice that would be followed by all of us. So we will talk to Dr. Dale a little bit later in the program. But first, buckle up. We're going to get in the Ford car and take a break right now and come back, talk about the future of Ford in the U.S. and around the world. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It is 1219 here in the Allstate Showcase studio along Michigan Avenue on this beautiful summer day in Chicago. On the phone line now is Dale Buss. He writes about the auto industry for Forbes, Chief Executive Magazine, and elsewhere. Dale, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for the invitation. Happy to be here.
Let's start a little bit by talking in general the auto industry and China and what's going on there. You know, as I recall, last week or maybe a couple of weeks ago, China talked about easing some tariffs, and now today the government says the U.S. government is talking about imposing these new $25 billion in tariffs. So where does the auto industry fit in all of that, this stuff going on between the U.S. and China and trade?
Well, obviously, the auto industry is crucial. I mean, you know, China's policy has been pretty much, you know, you build here, right? I mean, we're not exporting a lot of cars to China. So the trade stuff back and forth, I think, is probably not all that impactful for the long term of the China auto market, nor for U.S. companies, because you know they're going to work it out. And if you look at what the Trump administration has been doing with, you know, North Korea back and forth, with NAFTA back and forth, I mean, I think it's pretty evident that it's going to end up in a place that doesn't seem as threatening or maybe consequential as, you know, as it looks right now.
It's a very interesting response, because I think it's one a lot of us are going to be having about a lot of things. So you know they're going to work it out, because what you're really saying is, you know, we're not going to react too quickly to what comes out of this White House, because it changes by the day.
Right. I mean, Trump's style is to get everybody all agitated, shake things up, you know, get things in motion, you know, flood the zone, as somebody I read this morning was talking about him, and then let it all shake out. And, you know, you may agree or disagree with it, but his idea of make America first is kind of, that's his anchor, right? So he wants it to all work out for U.S. jobs and U.S. companies in the long run. And, you know, another piece of it is he's got to rely on the Chinese to bring Kim Jong-un to the table, to stay there, to talk seriously about the nukes. So it's all related. You know, we've got a whole military standoff with the Chinese now. So this is the way he just loves to put a whole bunch of pieces in play, and he wants you to kind of know, I think, if you're on the other side of a table, that he could move a piece in any direction. It could be a piece you don't expect. So again, a lot of short-term attention to this, and it gets the markets upset. But I think the CEOs of American auto companies, for example, the folks in the business I've talked to, you know, understand that it's all a big tableau, and you know, they're pretty optimistic that he's not just going to screw things up.
I want to ask you about something else I saw right before the show started. I don't know if you've seen it, so I don't mean this to be an unfair question. If you don't know it, just tell me. But I read a headline where China was going to invite more private money into the auto industry there. Did you see that today?
No, although I think it's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, I think they can... The government has a certain amount of expertise, and the native auto companies do, but it certainly could benefit from I think more private capital and more input. You know, if you look at, for example, China's plans to penetrate the U.S. market, I mean, they keep showing up at auto shows once every few years and saying that they're ready, but you never see them for sale. You don't see them in showrooms. I mean, I think there is a lot for the Chinese auto industry to learn, you know, from the Japanese, from Koreans, from American and European companies. And you know, they're doing that.
You have written a couple of articles recently about Ford CEO Jim Hackett, and in one of them you talk about how the Ford market share in China has been dropping, right? That's something they need to focus on.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is, I mean, I mentioned that in as one of the problems that Jim Hackett is confronting just a year into his tenure as CEO. I mean, I think his starting date was May 23rd last year. So I think that that's something that is on his plate, let's say, right, along with concerns about their car line. And he has, of course, said, you know, we're going to eliminate sedans over the next few years, and we're just going to put all our money on pickup trucks and SUVs. So he's had some stuff to deal with, and I think it's taken him longer than he anticipated to get his arms around what the problems were at Ford.
Ford says that in just a couple of years, 90% of their vehicles sold will be SUVs or crossovers. Just in a couple of years, 90%.
Yeah.
First of all, I want you to explain that for me, and I'm assuming the answer is obviously that that's what I drive. I have a crossover, and what we have an SUV. But the fact is, the gas prices are going to go up again, and it seems to me like those types of cars or sedans are going to be a little more attractive one day. I don't understand why they're abandoning them.
Well, first of all, you know, they did a great job of reshaping their car fleet for 2008 in that era when gas prices did go to $4 a gallon and more. The thing that shifted since then is, A, gas prices settled down. American consumers shifted dramatically toward an interest in SUVs and crossovers and, of course, pickup trucks. And what he's doing is simply acknowledging what Chrysler already did a couple of years ago, that you simply can't make money making sedans in the U.S. The thing about it is, though, that Ford is a leader in fuel economy for its SUVs as well. They've got a technology called EcoBoost, right, which gives you six-cylinder power in a four-cylinder engine, and eight-cylinder in a six-cylinder engine. And so people aren't paying the fuel economy penalty by buying SUVs and even trucks anymore.
You know, I drive a Ford Escape, and it has an EcoBoost engine, so I know what you mean there.
And so people can be confident that, hey, I don't want to buy a Focus. I want something like an Escape with some room. I think gas prices obviously are a huge wild card, but I think the auto industry and the Trump administration are counting on the Saudis and American frackers, you know, to keep things more or less in line so that people aren't alarmed and say, man, I should never have sold my Ford Focus. I don't see those days necessarily returning, you know, for geopolitical and as well as fuel economy.
Okay, one more. We've got less than a minute, but let's talk about autonomous vehicles and what's going on there. Ford, it's not leading the way, right? And that's going to be a challenge for Hackett as well.
No, it's not. And that was a problem for his predecessor and arguably maybe the thing that got him swept out, Mark Fields, is he just didn't seem to. And internally, that must have been evident that he wasn't taking the automated vehicle revolution, let's say, as seriously as he needed to. And Hackett, who, you know, has a background through his affiliation with Steelcase, where he was the CEO, he knows the people in Silicon Valley. He knows the importance of this technology. That's something he's trying to get the company to move more quickly on. But there's no way at this point, and maybe even in the next few years, that Ford could be considered a leader. And that is going to be a problem for them. I mean, they might be one of those companies that almost hopes that the automated vehicle revolution slows down, you know, thanks to these safety and regulatory and legislative factors, maybe giving them a time to catch up with, you know, people like Mercedes and perhaps Tesla.
Dale Buss writes for Forbes.com, Chief Executive Magazine as well, and joins us from time to time. Dale, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
Okay, so maybe you spent part of your holiday weekend at the soccer pitch, right? Your kids were playing AYSO soccer or maybe softball, and it's, they're six or they're eight or they're nine. And, well, they're not going to grow up to be softball players. You know that. They're probably not going to grow up to be soccer players. You want them to grow up to be a doctor. Dr. Dale Okorodudu is on a phone line, and he's got just the book for you. Doctor, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hey, Steve, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. One of the things about this book, though, that jumps out to me is you know, I think everyone who's in a profession, and it's a profession that they think everyone else or a lot of other people say, oh, I'd love to do that. I'd love to be a pilot. I'd love to be on the radio. I'd love to do this. Once you start talking to people in that industry, they don't love it necessarily as much as other people think they do. I have a lot of friends who are doctors who wouldn't be so keen maybe on their kids becoming doctors. I just wonder what you think about that, and if you are hearing from a lot of parents who feel otherwise.
Yeah, that's definitely a true sentiment. A lot of physicians who have gone through the process, I realize how difficult it is, and they think back to their training, and when you think back to your training, it's not necessarily something you would want your child to go through. Me personally, although the training was difficult, I still see, you know, the fruits of the work and how great of a career it actually is, and ultimately, at the end of the day, you get to take care of patients, and that's what you set out to do. So as long as you're okay with your kid getting through that difficult, grueling training, I think most physicians are probably still okay with their kids pursuing this career.
You've got a lot of different things going on. Are you still in the office, still seeing patients?
I am. Yes, I am.
All right. So tell me about how you set about to gather information for this book. You talked to parents of people who were doctors, right?
Exactly. So what I did was, you know, a mother a few years ago asked me, how do you raise a doctor? I said, well, I can't answer it because I haven't raised a doctor yet. I'm still relatively young. And my kids are young, but what I can do is ask all my physician friends to connect me with their parents. So I actually sent a survey to a lot of their parents, and I interviewed a lot of them, spoke to them, met with a lot of them, and I collected survey information and interview information, and I took the most valuable bits of information from them to put together in this book.
You know, what struck me about what I've read about the book is that the information they gave you and that you relayed on wasn't so much about a STEM education or anything like that. It was about encouragement. It was about fostering their children.
You're exactly right. So in How to Raise a Doctor, one of the things that I learned and that the parents really emphasized was values, character traits, and I'd say probably the biggest thing that the parents emphasized or that I could gather from what they told me was they were very, very involved with their kids' developments, meaning that they learned the process, how to get into medical school. They helped your children pick your friends, all sorts of ways that I never would have thought was unique to parents of physicians. You know, these parents all had these certain things in common about being very involved and engaged in their children's development.
Well, do you think that is the case, that that's what led them to be doctors, or that really you just were interviewing 75 sets of good parents? You know what I'm saying?
I mean, that definitely contributed to it.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder if...
Yeah.
Because there are people in other courses of business or other arts or things like that who have parents just like that. That's kind of the point I'm trying to make. I don't know how specific it would be to the medical industry.
Yeah, I'm not certain that that's 100% specific to the medical industry. I'll tell you, so in the second chapter of the book, one of the things that I point out is 78% of the parents that we surveyed didn't actually intentionally raise their children to be doctors. So, you know, you're exactly right. What they actually did was they paid keen attention to what their children's interests were and what their children were good at, and they encouraged that. And the other 22% of parents who did raise their children to be doctors, it seems as though those kids actually wanted to be doctors from a young age anyway.
Right.
So, a lot of these kids had that interest already. The parents just did a very good job of learning the process to get them there, and the parents were very involved in making it happen for them.
It seems to me probably that parents who tried to raise their children to be doctors were less successful at doing it than parents who raised their children to do what they wanted to do.
Exactly. Yeah. You're 100% correct, and it's also dangerous to try to push your child to become a doctor.
Trust me, yeah.
That's not what they want to do.
Mine are older than yours. I can say that is absolutely true. We're talking to Dale Okorodudu, a doctor and the author of How to Raise Your Child to Be a Doctor. Okay, so there's that. Fascinating stuff there. I want to talk to you about black men in white coats as well, because that looks like a pretty fascinating organization and endeavor you're under. Tell me about that. Black men in white coats.
Yeah, so, you know, we launched Black Men in White Coats back in 2013 because at that point in time, the American Association of Medical Colleges came out with this report, their initial report on this, that the number of black men applying to medical school was actually declining. And, you know, when you think about that, over a 30-year span, the number was going down, and that was really alarming. So we just thought there's got to be some way we can inspire these children and we can provide them mentors. So that's what we do. We focus on making inspirational videos, providing them resources, online tools. And maybe one of the bigger things is connecting them with mentors who are in the medical field to help encourage them to pursue careers in the field of medicine and to help once they actually decide they want to do medicine, to help them make it through, because it's a difficult process.
You know, one of the things George Bush, the younger, said as president, that the one thing really that has stayed with me more than anything, was he talked, he liked to talk about the bigotry of low expectations and how that keeps opportunity and keeps people down. I thought of that quote when I was reading about your story, when you were a college kid flying home to Texas from Missouri, sitting next to a woman who just didn't expect much from you.
Exactly. So on that particular case you're talking about, I was flying home and I was wearing the typical, you know, clothing that somebody of my generation would have been wearing, sweats and maybe a hoodie. And for a 2-hour flight, she just sat next to me and told me I couldn't speak well. She said I looked funny and literally told me I was never going to be successful. And she had no idea that I'm sitting there. Here I am, a kid who's making straight A's in college and all sorts of things. And she's setting these expectations on me. And I think it's important that we teach the next generation, don't let other people set your expectations for you. You have to set your own expectations.
And you certainly have done that and exceeded. So tell me then about Black Men in White Coats, the fact that it's really sounds to me like this is about a mentoring program, right? This is getting young people in front of, whether it's in person or via Skype or computer, with older people who are successful and in the medical industry.
Exactly. You're correctly right. So it's twofold. Part one is inspiration. And with that inspiration, we hope to draw them in to the point where we can reach them and help connect them with mentors, connect them with schools, and give them the resources. But, you know, the easiest way to be successful at anything is to have somebody who's done it show you how to do it. So that's why we're so keen and so focused on providing these students with mentors, because we know that without having a mentor who can show you how to do it, it's, you know, 100 times more difficult to accomplish that same task.
Why, me as a white guy, why should I be concerned or encourage that there be more African-American doctors in this country? What's in it for us?
So there's a lot. So obviously the health care of the population at large, if you can get more individuals who come from diverse backgrounds, that can increase the health care, just because perhaps they might go back and take care of these communities they come from, which might not have as good access to health care and so on. But the other part of it is it's talent mining. So if we can bring the best and brightest from all backgrounds to the table to come up with new ideas, new research, new ways of treating people, that benefits society at large.
It
so
also,
it's not just something as though black men only help black students or black communities.
It also fights that idea of the bigotry of low expectations. If my kids, if they're toddlers or middle school kids and they're being treated by an African-American doctor, that's going to affect the way they see the world, which is a good thing as well. Dr. Dale Okorodudu, the name of the book is How to Raise Your Child to Be a Doctor. It was nice to talk to you. I hope we can do it again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. We all know that the healthcare industry has big money behind it, but if you have the next big thing, there's going to be some serious cash backing it up. Two Chicago-based startups, Aptinix and Ethereum Therapeutics, are making the moves to make their companies public. These two in particular have made other buyouts look like chump change, with $100 million funding rounds and multi-billion dollar purchases. No matter where the economy goes, healthcare will likely always be towards the top in the business world. And remember that behind the healthcare, there is a business driver. That's why the National Cancer Center Institute's Small Business Innovation Research is hosting a webinar tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. to share info all about funding, National Cancer Institute business resources, and the direction of healthcare. All thanks to the Women's Business Development Center. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, it's summer. It's time to unwind a little bit. But are you still able to unwind? Alan Lightman's on a phone line. He's a physicist, a novelist, and more. And he's worried about your free time. His new book is In Praise of Wasting Time. Alan, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Nice to be on your show, Steve.
You know, I feel like I am doing everything constantly. I'm always doing things, but really never, ever doing anything. That I'm never focused or in a moment of one task. I'm always worried about the next task. And I'm not alone, am I?
No. I think we're the modern world, especially in the U.S. and other Western countries, is moving too fast for its own good. And we're also plugged in to the grid 24/7.
Psychologists say that if you, you know, this is a business show, that that workers in the workplace are switching tasks on average of every 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the businesses that have set aside certain quiet hours of the day or allowed their workers to do a little meditation while at work have seen increased profits. People are calmer, they're more productive if they have some quiet time in the day when they're not plugged in.
I want to get to those suggestions in just a bit, but first I want to, you know, my son over the last weekend spent 2 hours drawing. He was doing a self-portrait, and, you know, it wasn't bad. He came up and he showed me, and I said, you know, it looks nice, do this or do that. And he said, yeah, well, there's 2 hours I'll never get back. And that sort of betrayed almost a feeling of shame for not having an accomplishment. And I tried to explain to him that you're not wasting time if you're doing something that you enjoy.
Yeah. Well, we feel guilty when we're not doing some assigned task. I think it's deep in our Puritan background that idleness is considered a sin, actually. But in fact, when we have quiet time, when we're not doing assigned tasks, when we're just letting our minds wander, we're actually more productive. That a lot of creativity comes when we're not doing scheduled activities, when we're just letting our minds roam free.
You actually describe or compare the situation to global warming when it comes to us societally in worrying about this and losing our creativity because of that. I want you to explain that for me, because that seems to be quite a comparison.
Well, we over the last decade or so, we have, most of the world has become conscious of environmental destruction. That human beings are destroying our environment, but it's taken some time for us to acknowledge that fact. And I think in a similar way, we are destroying our inner lives by rushing around in a frantic state all the time, never unplugging, never giving ourselves time to think about who we are and what our values are and where we want to go in our lives. We're destroying our inner selves. It's something that's less visible than environmental destruction and not fully acknowledged yet. But I think that it's an urgent matter, and we may be already past the point of no return, just as we may be with global warming.
Well, so if we're losing our inner selves, what you're saying is we're losing our introspection, we're losing our ability to think quietly, or what do you mean by losing our inner selves?
Well, what I mean is that we use our personal reflection to think about things that we've done in our past, some things that we're proud of, some things that we regret, our memories. And we use quiet time to think about what our life goals are and what has meaning to us. And those are all part of, you might call, consolidating our self-identity, who we are. But you need quiet, reflective time for such thoughts. And if you're rushing around all day just checking off items on your to-do list, if you've got your smartphone with you when you're taking a walk out in the woods or checking your email when you're at a restaurant, if you're just on the treadmill all day long, then you don't have that quiet time to nourish your inner self.
I know myself, I don't read as much as I used to because I read with the phone beside me. I mean, I'm trying to make a conscious effort to stop that, but it's measurable in my case. So what you're describing to me seems almost like the benefits of religion or meditation, where there's quiet ritual, where there's stillness, and that's what we're missing.
Yes, we are. But because the world around us is all rushing, 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 it's very hard to disengage for 30 minutes a day. We feel like we're falling behind. In fact, there's a syndrome among young people called FOMO, FOMO.
Sure, yeah.
Fear of missing out. And young people are so aware of what all their friends are doing, what clothes they're buying, what new gadgets they bought. They have to check with them constantly, and there's a fear of missing out. I think a recent study showed that teenagers send out and receive more than 110 text messages a day.
Mm.
And it's not healthy. It's caused an increase in depression among young people. It's caused an increase and a decrease in creativity, all of which has been documented. And we're damaging ourselves.
And I was laughing with you before we started recording, because we spoke on the phone briefly earlier, and I was rushing through because I felt like I had so much to do. I arrived in the office today with 150 emails. 146 of them probably were useless to me, but there's just this sort of, it's just a deluge of things that don't stop. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that we might be beyond the point of return. I mean, do you think this is an unfixable? There's two things, I guess. Is this an individual problem, or is this a societal or a world problem? Is it reversible?
All of those.
Yeah,
it's all of those things, and I think it is reversible if we acknowledge it and we commit ourselves to changing our habits of mind. We succeeded in doing that with cigarette smoking. But it took several decades of warnings by the medical profession and increasing taxes on cigarettes for us to get out of that bad habit. So it takes a long time to change a lifestyle habit. But I think it is possible.
Talking to Alan Lightman, a physicist and the author of the book In Praise of Wasting Time. All right, let's talk about a couple of solutions. You mentioned that K-12 students, you'd like a quiet time for them every day during the school year.
10 minutes a day.
10 minutes a day.
10 minutes a day.
I'm interested in college students and your introspective intensive courses that you suggest every semester. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that I think that in college that every department, whether it's chemistry or history, should have a course that you could call an introspective intensive course, where there is a reduced amount of homework and a reduced amount of reading. But instead, with that extra time, students are encouraged to reflect and think about what they've learned, and to maybe write a thoughtful essay about what they've learned, to think about what they're learning. If the college curricula are so crammed full of assignments, then the students don't have time to think about what they're learning. And that's all connected to what we're talking about.
I mean, it goes to the teachers. The teachers are worried about losing 10 or 15 minutes of classroom time for one special event or another, because they feel, whether it's true or not, they feel they've got so much to get in. This is a business show. You also suggest quiet time in the workplace, like a half an hour a day per employee. Boy, that seems like a tough sell.
Yeah, it's a tough sell, but if you can link it to increased productivity and show that the bottom line is greater income for the company or their business, which I think has been shown in various studies, that I think that it may be a good sell. I think that every business should have a quiet room or something equivalent to that, and allow their employees to spend a half an hour there with no digital devices allowed. And you don't have to meditate. You just are quiet for a half an hour. And I think it refreshes the mind. It enhances creativity. And I think that it's good for business.
I remember just riding on the bus and sticking my, resting my head against the window, looking out the window, just sort of dissolving for a while. That's the sort of stuff that's gone away as long as we're holding computers wherever we are.
Yes, definitely.
Alan Lightman, in praise of wasting time. I'm going to try to waste some time in your honor on this long holiday weekend. Thank you for that.
Great.
All right, we'll talk again. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.